Welcome and thank you very much for joining us on episode 156 of the Blazers Edge podcast, presented to you today by BlazersEdge.com. I'm your weekend host, Chris Lucia.
And I am your weekend co-host, Brandon Goldner. If you want to hit us up, you can send us an email at BlazersEdgePodcast@gmail.com. You can also find us on iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, and now Google Play. And we would very much appreciate if you wanted to rate and review and subscribe, whether you think the show is great or it sucks. We would like to hear from you, so please give us a hit.
Returning to the Blazers Edge Weekend podcast for the second time is B-Ball Breakdown contributor James Hollis, a.k.a. Snotty Drippin. James, thanks for coming on the show this week, man.
Hey, fellas. Thanks for having me again. I appreciate it. Let's do it.
James, really good to have you. We just got news today that the NBA All-Star Game is being pulled from Charlotte. As we know, North Carolina passed a bill a little while ago that, in my view, and just me personally speaking, unfairly targeted the LGBT community. Obviously, this was a tough decision for the NBA, a difficult decision, and there are a lot of different considerations to be made with that. But James, I just wanted to get your take on this. The NBA taking somewhat of a social stand. I know that when I post stuff like this on the Blazers Edge Facebook page, a comment that comes back a lot is, I follow the Blazers because I care about sports. You know, I don't want to mix politics and sports. And James, I just wanted to get your opinion on that and what the NBA did to move the All-Star game out of Charlotte.
Well, and, you know, you guys would be remiss if you didn't bring this up. This is a huge deal. And I don't think we're mixing politics and sports. I think that this is about what's right and what's wrong. And the NBA is standing for what's right, honestly. It doesn't matter about people's personal feelings about what other people do in their private lives. I think a lot of falsehoods are going around. But I think the NBA made a clear stance here that any kind of oppression, any kind of bias won't be stood for by lawkeepers, by individuals. And they made a big stand. And it's going to cost the city of Charlotte a lot of money. I hope it gives the people in Charlotte and the political guys and the guys in office think about how they treat other people and the laws that they put in effect. So if you got to drag certain places in the Bible Belt kicking and screaming to the present, I'm glad that the NBA is part of being progressive.
And that's an interesting point. The NBA is a league, not only the league, but the players themselves. I mean, speaking of, you know, the kind of the intersection of politics and sports, we've also seen, with the Black Lives Matter movement, NBA players, going back to a couple years ago, Nicola Batum, when he was with the Blazers, you know, he wore a shirt that says, "I can't breathe," you know, paying homage to the gentleman in New York who was killed by police. LeBron James did the same thing. You know, recently you had WNBA players, for their warm-up shirts, were wearing shirts that paid homage both to the five police officers who were killed in Dallas, but also to those African Americans who were killed by police. And I think more and more what you're seeing are NBA players that are not afraid to use their voice and use that platform to talk about issues that can be tough and contentious. And I also wanted to get your take on this, James, because we were talking a little bit before the podcast started about how players back in the 60s and 70s were a little bit more politically active. Then during the 80s and 90s, became a little bit less so, maybe a little bit more concerned about their brand and about appealing to a wider audience. But I wanted to get your take on players using their power and their platform and the recognition that they get as basketball players to talk about things outside of basketball. And just I wanted to ask how, you know, what your take on that was.
You hit the nail on the head. Back in the day, guys like Bill Russell and Muhammad Ali, they were willing to, you know, go above and beyond to stand up for what they believed in and for social justice and equality. And I think in the 80s and 90s, when the money started skyrocketing, it's easy to see a lot of players would rather, you know, they want to jeopardize their brand for money making. Michael Jordan, you guys brought it up. He famously had the statement about not speaking up on things, but he said Republicans buy shoes too.
Yep.
I think it's refreshing to see athletes now embracing their inner self and speaking up from their conscience and from what they believe is right over maybe monetary concerns. Let's be real. The Black community has long, complained about police brutality and maybe unfair treatment from certain aspects of law enforcement. law enforcement is necessary and it's not bad, but if there's elements in law enforcement that are treating people fair by their skin color, that needs to be addressed. With the rise of cell phone cameras, I think we're seeing a lot more of it and it's become a focus. So when Black Lives Matter is a thing, it's not Black Lives Matter more or only Black Lives Matter. It's Black Lives Matter as well and as much as every other life. And that's all they want. And so the fact that athletes are speaking up and addressing this, and like WNBA, they were fining the player $500 a piece. Teams got fined $5,000 for it. It's a struggle, and I can't see it from that side.
And wasn't there a WNBA player who, after they were fined for wearing that warm-up shirt, she went to Twitter, and I apologize that I forgot her name. She went to Twitter basically to say, a picture of her wearing the shirt, saying, you know, at WNBA, you can't silence me. And to me personally, I mean, I'm a very privileged individual in American culture. I'm a white male, and I carry that privilege with me every day, and I recognize that. But I mean, to me, doing the right thing is always the right thing to do. And so personally, I'm glad that NBA players and the league are standing up for what they believe is right.
And you hit the nail on the head. That's Tina Charles. She tweeted at the WNBA official Twitter account. She said, "You can't silence me," and that's a huge shift. She's bucking people who pay her, and she's within her right to do that. I think for any societal change, there will be a little unrest and uneasiness. So I think people get uncomfortable talking about these kind of things, but there's never a comfortable time to talk about racial justice. So the fact that you guys bring it up now, the fact that these players are doing this on their public platform, the fact that we had the guys go on ESPN, LeBron, Chris Paul, Carmelo, and they said something about it, the fact that Carmelo put a full page ad, those things, they matter. And I think slowly but surely, getting those public voices out there, it helps. It helps, and I think it's going to cause a lot of conversation, and things will get better.
You guys are absolutely right, and I think, you know, bringing this up at the beginning of the podcast here, of the Blazers Edge podcast, it's indicative of what you can do if you have a platform to talk about issues like this. It's, you know, you're seeing players, as you guys both mentioned, speak up more and more than they had in the 80s and 90s with, you know, guys like Magic Johnson and Michael Jordan being involved so heavily in business, deciding not to go down that route. And now you're seeing more and more players do that. So for the Blazers Edge listeners, we just wanted to give you guys the opportunity to hear about this kind of stuff. If this is not something that you're used to hearing, you know, this is important. This is something that's going on in society today. So we're very happy to bring multiple perspectives to you so that you can hear this, even though this is a basketball podcast. And you know, with that in mind, there was a lot going on this summer with the NBA, James, and that wasn't the most graceful segue there. But you know, the NBA, man, this summer, salary cap exploding, free agency, man, rumors about guys like Dwight Howard, Hassan Whiteside. I mean, so many different things happened. Where do we even want to start with this?
Let's start with Mike Conley Jr. Mike Conley Jr. has been in the league for, I'm not sure, 7-8 years now. It's getting up there, you know, 6-7 years. This is great radio. I'm making stuff up, kind of off the cuff.
Isn't he on like the super max, the, you know, 10 years or more of service in the NBA? Isn't that why he got contract?
No, I don't think he's even there yet.
He was drafted in 07, the same draft as Odin and Kevin Durant.
Oh, wow. Mike Conley is?
So I think he's going into his 10th year, I believe, yeah.
So either way, he's not a you know, young spring chicken. So
not a spring chicken.
Wow. So, yeah, when we all heard that Mike Conley signed a $153-155 million contract, and it's the largest contract ever for somebody who was never in I think it was in the NBA. I've never heard of a player signing for that much, so it's the largest contract ever in the NBA.
I think it's, yeah, largest contract period to this point.
I balked. I really, like, shuddered. It was a visceral reaction because, man, I think 29 other teams might have given a sigh of relief because I don't think anybody else wanted to pay him that kind of money. It's Mike Conley. He's a quality player. He's a top 10 point guard. But is he? Oh, man. So, yeah, we all knew the exploding cap would do a lot of weird things. And, you know, we saw actually a play that you all are very well aware of. Mr. Allen Crabbe got a huge contract out of it. And it's crazy. In a couple of years, I think the average starter is going to be making $15, $16 million from what I'm hearing. So that's just, it's hard to get your mind around. So, yeah, there was some crazy money thrown around, and it's wild.
So Mike Conley, I'm gonna go ahead and call him a top seven point guard just to kind of hedge my bets there. And he's legitimately all-star caliber. I mean, we know he hasn't made an all-star team yet, but he is in the West. He's going up against some pretty stiff competition there. Either way, that is a freaking ton of money to give to a guy like that. But, you know, that's the reality of what the NBA is going to be from now going forward, at least with this kind of basketball-related income affecting the salary cap. So, James, you kind of mentioned that was kind of a deal that made you really turn your head quite a bit. But I think if you look at it, it kind of is what it is now. Guys are going to have to pay players of that caliber, that kind of money to stick around.
But did that deal, did it make you Evan Turner your head?
Unbelievable, dude. Unbelievable.
Did I just ruin the last part of our podcast? We're going to spend 20 minutes on Evan Turner.
Oh, geez. So we'll get to ET in a minute because James has been following the Boston Celtics for a while. He has a bit more of a closer view on ET's game than we do. But real quick before we transition to that, I want to ask you, James, looking around, that Mozgov deal was pretty freaking horrible. I mean, the Mike Conley deal was bad. That Mozgov deal was terrible. So what in your eyes was, or maybe a couple of them, what were some of the really, really bad deals handed out this summer that come to mind? Did I just steal the thunder by saying Mozgov there?
You did. That was the deal right there that I think the Lakers really overestimated the market. And they threw this money at him, and we've seen, I would say, probably more productive, better, more quote unquote modern centers get less money for a reason. And so that was a really bad deal. I'm trying to think of a few more that might have really raised my eyebrows. That's basically the one that just made me. I'm sorry. Jeff Green got 16, almost 17 million for 1 year in Orlando, and people say it's only 1 year. It doesn't matter. It matters because Orlando's a young team that has a lot of things to do. So it has to find itself. Why would you throw that much money at a small forward that you don't need? And we all know Jeff Green is Jeff Green. He looks like a good player, but the idea of Jeff Green is better than Jeff Green. So that was a bad one.
Every single team that has had Jeff Green going back to the Celtics, and I'm sure you could attest to this, they've seen him on paper and what he brings to the game, or the physical tools that he brings to the game. They think, oh, this is a combo guy who can play a little bit of small forward. He can stretch up to the four, stretch the floor for us. Well, it didn't work out in Boston, didn't work out in OKC, didn't work out in Memphis, didn't work out to the degree that they expected it to in Los Angeles. So I'm with you on that one, man. That Orlando deal, that's kind of a head scratcher for me.
Yeah, I would also argue that Dwayne Wade deal is a terrible deal, and not just because he's old. I mean, because he had a good year last year. The thing is, the composition of that Bulls team does not lend itself to absorbing a player like Dwayne Wade. So I know that a lot of these contracts can be taken in a vacuum, that they're poor just based on what the player brings. But as far as you're talking about a free agent fit with the team, that was one of the worst fits that I've seen, that Jimmy Butler, Rondo, and Dwayne Wade. I don't know what they're going to do to spread the floor kind of at all with that, but...
So I would argue that the actual bad fit there is Rondo, because I think if you just had Jimmy Butler and Dwayne Wade, you'd make that work because they're very good players. The fact that they threw Rondo in that mix for whatever reason, I think he's only getting, I don't know, 10 million. I don't know what this deal was.
Something like that.
Yeah. So I think that's what made it. I'm going to say he's the bad deal, because while Wade could be valuable and Jimmy Butler could be valuable, I personally look, and Rondo, hey, Rondo, I tip my hat to you for what you did in Boston. But that was, we're talking almost 10 years ago now, brother. So it's time to start hanging your hat on, being great with three Hall of Famers, and he hasn't been good for the last 3-4 years.
Is he a good fit? And I mean, you mentioned that in Chicago he was a bad fit. Is there any of the other 29 teams where he would be considered a good fit?
I mean, if you have a team that has nobody who wants to handle the ball and everybody can shoot. I mean, I'm assuming because Rondo's a ball dominant guard who can't really shoot himself. He's an excellent passer, and that's about all he can bring at this point. I don't know how many surgeries later and how old he is. He can't defend the way he used to be able to defend. No teams come to mind.
If Eric Bledsoe fell into a black hole and there was no one to run the point, well, even though they had Brandon Knight, you put Brandon Knight too, I could see him working with a young Phoenix team with all those scores who need the ball. And that'd be fun. They're not going to win anything, but at least he'd have a place that he fits. as far as actually winning basketball, no, I don't see anywhere. There's nowhere in the league where it makes that team even marginally better. We know he's a we can hash that up today. I feel the game might have passed Rondo by, and people look at those assists and they're going to talk crap to me about this on Twitter, but it is what it is.
I used to play, I mean, I guess I assume we all used to play NBA Jam back in the day, Sega Genesis, Super Nintendo. My older brother was the kind of dude who would always try to set the record for assists. So he'd go out there, he'd go up for the freaking layup, and he was in the middle of it, and he'd kick it out for the three and get the assist. He ended up with like 38 or 40 assists for one game or something. And that's like, to me, I mean, isn't that kind of what Rondo is, like passing up good shots for himself in order to maybe potentially grab an assist?
It's so funny that you say that, Chris, because my absolute least favorite move in basketball is when you're on a fast break and it's like 2-on-0 and the guy goes up for the layup and he's like, no, I'm going to dump it off to the dude behind me for the free assist. It's like, that honestly, that shouldn't even count. That should be like a negative assist and like negative 2 points and a foul.
Yeah, we can see a riff on Rondo all day. The assists look great, and yeah, he shot like 36% from three last year on like half a shot a game or whatever. Let's be real. He's not explosive. He's not a great player, and I don't know what they're doing in Chicago. So any Bulls fans listening, my condolences to you guys.
It's just so ironic to me that the guy who's going for all these assists is being called selfish for it. And I mean, it's justifiable at this point. I just think it's ironic and pretty funny. But, you know, another guy who isn't particularly known for his shooting, the Blazers... on July, I guess June 30th or whatever, at midnight, the rumors were Chandler Parsons, maybe Hassan Whiteside, eventually shifted to Pau Gasol, whatever. Somewhere in the midst there, Neil Olshey decided to swoop up Evan Turner from the Boston Celtics for 4 years, $70 million. So, James, you being a guy who knows the Celtics better than any of us at Blazers Edge, you know, what's your first take here on Evan Turner coming to the Blazers?
Oh, buddy. So the Blazers zigged when everybody else was zagging, huh? Everybody else wants to get faster and dangerous from the three-point line. And they got the guy who's not quick and can't shoot a three to save his life. Okay, so get that bleep button ready here, all right? Because we had Evan Turner in Boston for a little while. So here it is. I hate Evan Turner. I couldn't stand his face. I couldn't stand to hear his annoying voice. I couldn't stand his stupid haircut. I couldn't stand the stupid way he dribbled the basketball, bent over like a cartoon. I can't stand the stupid way he crossed over and tried to. I can't stand the stupid way he shoots. I couldn't stand anything about Evan. If I could, I'd trip Evan Turner everything around the court. I would push him down the hallway and knock his books out of his hands. I couldn't stand freaking Evan Turner. So,
okay. Before we, I know.
That's like how we feel about Raymond Felton as Blazer fans after what he did. And that's like a lot of ire that Blazer fans have for Raymond Felton. And I, like, from everything I heard, it seemed like Celtics fans and generally, tell me if I'm generalizing too much here, but it seemed like the general consensus was that they were kind of bummed to see a guy like that go.
No, you're absolutely right. I'm a bad Celtics fan. I've said this before. I'm a terrible Celtics fan because I'm probably the only person who hated Evan Turner. And a lot of it stems just for the fact that, he tries so hard. He seemed like a nice guy. I get it. And he kind of, he flamed out in Philly. He was a bust. He went to Indiana and flamed out. I think he kind of, he didn't really help the chemistry of that team. Screw him, man. Screw him. Now, to be fair to him, you're getting a player who can do everything on the court but shoot threes. He wants to dominate the action with the basketball, which means he can lead your second unit pretty well. I think he'll be fine there, and you could run him out there with the other guys too and let them spot up some with Dame and CJ. He's a pretty strong rebounder. He can be a strong team defender. So he brings a lot of, to the floor. My problem with him, I guess, was Boston was a whole bunch of role players before we got the great Al Horford in town. And I got tired of seeing a bunch of role players, and I got tired of seeing this guy with his stupid slope haircut running around and cracking corny jokes. I got sick of it.
So I wanted to ask about that. I mean, and his basketball prowess notwithstanding, I heard a lot about Evan Turner and his media presence. So what's the deal there? Is he just does he just crack jokes, or does he not take it seriously, or is he like a fun interview, or is it like a shtick that gets annoying, or what's the deal?
People love him. He says wild, kind of outlandish things, and you know, like, hey, you know, if you're shooting, you know, 15% for three, I got to take him. I'm red hot. He I guess that's, you know, that milk and cookies kind of good, wholesome fun is what he is. I just, you know, I can't. Screw that guy. You know. he's a real cornball. He just gets on my nerves. And it shouldn't be like that because he helped us win a lot of games a medium amount of games. But yeah.
I think I have to officially gift you my Blazers Edge hot take oven mitts for that lava take on Evan Turner. So congratulations.
Well, I appreciate that. And I also appreciate more that you guys took him off our hands for almost $17 million a year.
The money is, I think, is when you take a step back and look at it, you're like, oh, okay, Evan Turner, we could see where he could fit in with the Trailblazers here. You know, they need another guy, like you mentioned, maybe with the second unit a little bit, who can do some playmaking. He can't shoot the three at all, but a guy who can handle the ball, who can get to the rim, who can set up his teammates. That's important, but I can't argue with anybody on the money thing. It doesn't look pretty. And again, you know, paying Allen Crabbe the kind of money that the Blazers paid him, and if they end up wanting to trade him down the line, I mean, that's not the most tradable contract in the world there either. So there's an interesting glut of players right now in the Blazers backcourt, and they're going to be making a lot of money. I mean, Dame's on his $25 million max extension, kicks in this year. CJ McCollum likely going to get the max on his extension. They're going to start negotiating that probably this summer. That's going to be in the $25 million ballpark. AC at 4 years, 70, and Evan Turner at 4 years, 70 as well. I mean, that's a lot of freaking money for that backcourt.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask too, because part of the narrative of getting Evan Turner in particular that we heard from Neil Olshey was, oh, well, now we have someone who can take the pressure off of both Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum. And James, I mean, do you buy into that narrative? I mean, I know that you're not like a huge Blazers fan, but you know Dame and CJ well enough. Like, is it useful to have a third person in the starting lineup who's going to take the ball out of their hands?
I'm begrudgingly giving this to Evan Turner. He's not scared of the moment. He can get to a spot from mid range and get to the rim decently, and he'll in the, you know, crunch time at key moments, he'll make a surprisingly good play. So I like Portland. I like what they've been doing. I don't think he's a perfect fit. I'm not sure why he was the first target, but I mean, now that you got him, it's too late to do anything about it. He's going to be useful.
I mean, either way, I think in the starting, because he was, you know, you hear in the press conferences and him talking to the media, you know, like he was, it sounds like he was promised that starting three spot when he signed. And Terry Stotts plans on moving Al-Farouq Aminu pretty much semi-permanently, it sounds like, to the power forward spot. You know, so that means Allen Crabbe is the guy coming off the bench. So you have the shooting coming off the bench, which is great. You're going to need that in the Blazers lineup. But Evan Turner, I feel like in the starting lineup, his best talents aren't going to be utilized the most. I think you need him in that second unit. But then you have to look at, you know, having some of the shooters around him because he can't shoot. So it's kind of, yeah, we keep coming back to it. It's just kind of a really weird fit. And I think we're hoping that Myers Leonard comes back healthy, ready to contribute. He can stretch the floor a little bit from that second unit. Maybe Noah Vonleh is able to pick up some minutes and able to hit a few shots. And, you know, Terry Stotts has done this for years, staggering the minutes of CJ McCollum and Damian Lillard such that there's always one or the other on the floor at all times, even if they both start together. So we're going to see, I think, in my eyes, quite a bit of staggering there with that three-man backcourt.
I'll just say that as a starter last year, he only started 12 games, but for you guys, this is promising. He averaged 15, 6, and almost 4 as a starter. He had a better true shooting percentage as a starter. We know the three-point percentage doesn't matter as a starter because he barely shot any, but he shot better from three as a starter. Small sample size, but he's one of those glue guys, man. And I'm with you. I think against second units, you can really beat them up and be more productive. And then, you know, even in the rotation with the starters later in the game, he can be that, you know, the lubricant for the offense, move the ball, make things happen. But hey, so far, so good. You guys surprised everybody last year. Blazers surprised everybody last year. So I'm not going to really question what they're doing.
Well, and taking a broader view of the Blazers free agency, I mean, we talked a little bit about Crab and Turner maybe overpays. We'd be remiss not to mention they got a couple of good deals. They got Azeli, you know, on a 2-year, $15 million with a team option on the second year. And yeah, it turns out his knees might be garbage, but I mean, with that level of risk, it's worth, you know, 1 year, $7 million. And then Myers Leonard, you know, super young. What is he, 24 still? And he got 4 years, $41 million. I'd be particularly interested, James, in what you think of. I mean, we kind of know what Azeli can do and what he does, but Myers Leonard is someone who has quite a bit of a potential. It's been yet to be tapped. Do you have a take on Myers Leonard at all, or have you seen him play a bunch?
I do have a take on him. I like him. I like his game. I'm still waiting to see him, I guess, take a mini leap forward where he becomes more consistent. No, that kind of, let's be real, he's what they call a modern big man. He can shoot the jumper. He's long. He's not really a good defender, but he's athletic. He can run the floor pretty well. Am I right? Am I hitting the? He's not a big. He's not a big plotting big guy. So let's see if he can put together. He's not physically dominant, but if you know, the pressure's not on him, it's on those other two guys, Dame and CJ.
And I want to give a shout out to our weekend podcast host, Chris Lucia, because Chris, you were the one that had been advocating that Blazers fans think about Myers Leonard not as a starter and someone who could become a star, but as a role player. And he just got paid as a role player, and I think the expectations from fans are going to be quite a bit more manageable, especially for a player like Myers Leonard, who clearly, you know, cares about the perception of him. I think it's going to be easier for fans to swallow a 4-year, $40 million contract.
Yeah, you took the words right out of my mouth, because, you know, with those Turner deals and those Crab deals being what they are, and then, you know, Myers kind of quietly, after all the chips had fallen, signing for that 4 years, $41 million. You know, just to echo what you said, you know, before you see that tantalizing athleticism, a big who can stretch the floor. You want a guy, you know, that quote unquote unicorn who can not only protect the rim on defense, but also stretch the floor on the other side, to where you don't have to worry about one side or the other of having, you know, your big out there. This contract is great, not only for the Blazers, for the, you know, for the fans who look at it, but also for Myers, I think. You know, just like you said, it lowers the expectations so much for him. And I've been saying this for a long time, you know, just look at him. You know, bench players in the NBA, they don't have to be exceptionally good at everything. They don't even have to be good across the board. You need guys who can specialize in certain aspects and not really screw the team over too much in other aspects of the game. Myers Leonard, he can play okay defense if he's used in the right way against the right personnel. I mean, that's what you kind of expect from a role player coming off the bench, stretching the floor. I mean, that's his specialty, coming off the bench. So now, hopefully, with the salary he's got, it looks to be pretty similar to what role players across the league, specialty guys, you know, bench unit guys have been getting across the league. So hopefully that kind of changes the framing through which we look at Myers Leonard.
Yeah, and I know it's been tough because the salary cap has gone up so much. I mean, would you guys agree that right now, given where the cap is at, a starting level player is like $14, $15 million? Yep. Is that about right? So yeah, and Myers, you know, getting 10 a year, that's pretty much perfect as far as I'm concerned.
So let's take a look a little bit and wrap up this podcast by talking about the Blazers competition in the Northwest Division, because the Blazers kind of started this, you know, rebuild, so to speak, last summer. As you mentioned, James, they surprised a lot of people by winning 44 games. Neil O'Shea has been no stranger this offseason to touting the fact that once they moved Al-Farouq Aminu to power forward, Mo Harkless into the starting lineup, and took Noah Vonleh out of the starting lineup, they were on pace for 54 wins. And that's kind of, I think a lot of fans are looking at that and saying, hey, you know, this team was on pace for 54 wins the second half of the season there, or after they took Vonleh out of the starting lineup. They didn't lose anybody, potentially Mo Harkless, we don't know about that. And only Chris Kaman and Cliff Alexander, some guys of not very huge consequence there. They're bringing back most of the same guys. They add some useful guys like Evan Turner, and then they add a guy who's kind of low risk, pretty high reward there if it works out, Festus Ezeli. So that you know, fans are really excited about next year. They're thinking about the playoffs, what they can do. But I want to look here in this Northwest Division because they're not the only team who made some moves this summer. And I think with that in mind, let's start with the Oklahoma City Thunder. Looking at their roster, they're down one very big man, huge shoes to fill in Kevin Durant, but they still got a lot of talent there. So James, what do you think about the core in Oklahoma City?
I thought you were going to say that, you know, they're one man down, but I said Deion Waiters didn't sign anywhere else yet.
He's still unrestricted.
Okay, so let's be real. The Thunder, I think they try their best to hope for the best and plan for the worst. When they moved for Oladipo, they moved out Serge Ibaka for Victor Oladipo. They were kind of hedging their bets. I don't think Durant would have minded that move, but I think that was also a move with an eye on what might happen. Oladipo's another not ball dominant, but he can be a ball dominant, like a first option kind of guy to put with Russell Westbrook. That, I think they automatically have the most athletic backcourt in the league, which, you know, it's faint praise after what just happened. They just lost, you know, a top three player in the NBA for basically nothing, cap space. There's a lot of talent there. The main question with them is what they're going to do with Russell Westbrook now. They're trying to get him to extend. And, you know, from what I understand, he'd probably make a little more money if he extends right now, because they can bump his salary for next year to that almost max level and then give him 3 more years, whatever. So it's not happening, though. He's going to test free agency at the very least. Good chance he walks away, too. But let's assume they move forward as is with Russell Westbrook. They still have a lot of talent there. And we saw Russ when Kevin Durant was out last a couple years ago. He made things happen. His numbers will be eye-popping. He'll win them some games. I think there's a little more talent around him now, and he's used to Enes Kanter, where he won't force the action like he did a couple years ago. And I think he's a little more mature now, obviously, with the ball and more comfortable with Donovan. They're still going to be in the mid-40s to 50 wins, and they're going to be in the playoffs. I think that Portland did enough to put themselves on them at that same level. And so it'll be interesting to see.
So one thing with Westbrook, the Thunder could choose to trade him to get something in return instead of letting him walk for nothing at the end of the year. And one thing I've heard more than once is a rumor that because of the players and the picks that Boston has, that they could make a run at Russell Westbrook. As a Celtics fan, how would that strike you having Westbrook on your team?
If Russell Westbrook came to Celtics, I'd go streaking in the quad and I'd do it on Skype. He's my favorite player in the NBA. He's just so explosive. He's so competitive and fierce. I know he has his flaws, but I love that guy. So if he came to join Al Horford, I think immediately that's the second best team in the East. And I think we're really going to push Cleveland, no, but it'd be fun to see. So it's a lot of talk. My take on it is a lot like Jesse Blanchard, another writer we have over at BYBreakdown.com. He wrote a piece about why you don't trade him. And one of the reasons, I mean, a top five player, you don't get that very often. You know, most teams never get one. And if they get one, you hold on to it. And yes, he might leave. But I think for Thunder fans, the return you get would not be worth seeing a year of a pissed off Russell Westbrook with tools at his disposal. So even if he walks, I think he leaves the memory. And I'd rather him leave on his own terms. I think they would rather him leave on his own terms than him get traded for, you know, a bunch of pieces and picks this year, and they get to watch a team stumble to 25 wins. So I think you just roll the dice and you sell him on, this is your franchise, we'll do anything we can for you now.
Yeah, Russ Westbrook is going to go absolutely nuts this year for the Thunder. I don't think that's any question. I mean, you look at the way he played when Kevin Durant was out of the lineup, and he's combined that with being in a contract year, you know, entering his prime, or I guess he's not entering his prime. He's right smack dab in the middle of it at age 27. Yeah. He'll be 28 right about the time the season starts. So, I mean, he's going to have a lot to prove. He's got a lot of depth around him. He's got a lot of talent. I think OKC isn't going to fall off quite as much as a lot of people expected to after after Kevin Durant left. But moving on, looking at the Utah Jazz here. So this is a team, you know, I really like their core nucleus of talent here. They don't have a super duper star, but Gordon Hayward, he's a great player. I think if he were outside of Utah, that's a guy that people would be talking about quite a bit as one of the better front court players who can play, you know, potentially play both positions. He's a great shooter. Derek Favors, very, very underrated front court player. He's been in the league. He's going into his seventh year. He's only going to be 25 years old this year. They have a very great young core. You know, Rodney Hood, they traded for Shelvin Mack. Let's see here. They have some guys coming back from injury. Rudy Gobert was hurt quite a bit last year. They ended the year at 40-42, number nine in the West, barely missed the playoffs. So, James, looking at the Utah Jazz, they didn't add a bunch of pieces this summer. I think Joe Johnson was the big signing for them. They have a couple of rookies there, but you know, bringing back the same team with some health, they were 40-42 last year. Do you think they're going to finish better than ninth in the West this year?
Oh, Chris, you missed the key to this offseason for them. Two keys. They brought in Boris Diaw and George Hill. Now, I say, we laugh. I say this is key. George Hill is one of the most underrated players in the NBA. George Hill won't wow you with his athleticism. He won't, you know, drop 25 a night. But to me, George Hill is right in that fringe of top 10 point guards where he does everything so well, you don't even notice him. And I think he's just exactly what Utah needed. Now, a cautionary tale for Portland. A lot like Portland this year, they ended the season 2 years ago on this hot streak, and you know they won a lot of games when they put Rudy Gobert in the starting lineup, and hey, they had this pace, and next year they should do a lot of big things. You never know how things will turn out with injuries and that kind of thing. So knock on wood that nothing happens to Portland. But Utah is, they obviously were ready to make that next step. They didn't want to get another rookie. They moved it for George Hill. George Hill is a perfect kind of glue guy who can hit threes, unlike Evan Turner, for them. He'll be the bridge between they sent out what's the guy's name? Trey Burke. Yep. They sent out Trey Burke and they got Shelvin Mack, who's kind of a journeyman. But now they got George Hill's an upgrade. He's the perfect bridge between, you know, now and Dante Exum. He allows them to bring Exum along slowly. Joe Johnson, the vet, canny vet, knows how to play the game. Boris Diaw, we've seen what he can do for the Spurs. They're three versatile, you know, capable guys, and those are the three oldest guys on the team.
Well, I mean, one thing about Boris Diaw that you might be a little concerned about is his motivation. Obviously, you know, he's been out of shape at times during his career with the Spurs. Extraordinarily strong system and extraordinarily well-respected coach in Greg Popovich. But then on the other hand, I mean, I think Quinn Snyder is one of the better young up-and-coming coaches and also visually probably the most frightening human being I've ever seen in my life. Just to get that right out of the way.
He's absolutely terrifying.
So George Hill was the IUPUI's finest. So that's quite a mouthful for there. Indiana University, Purdue University, Indiana. So shout out to him, man, for the alma mater there. Utah, I really think they're going to be quite improved. You guys mentioned the coaching. I think Gordon Hayward is just a straight up stud. If he takes the next step and becomes a legit all-star caliber player, he's already all-star caliber. If he becomes a legit all-star player, you know, the way that it looks like his trajectory is going, I think Utah Jazz, they're going to be a little bit better this year than the 40-42 record they had. Hopefully they, for their sake, I guess not as a Blazer fan, but for their sake, they get some health and they're able to, you know, bring out a solid starting lineup for the whole season. But let's move on to a team that kind of puzzles me, because I think in the modern NBA, you look at team construction and you want to build around a superstar or a guy who has superstar potential or superstar level talent here. And looking at the nucleus that they have, unless you think Emmanuel Mudiay has that kind of potential, I mean, he's a great up and coming young point guard. You know, you look at some of the guys they brought in, though. Jamal Murray, that guy's going to need some minutes in the backcourt there. Hernan Gomez is a guy they drafted in the first round. They hope can contribute the first year. They got Will the Thrill Barton, people's champ. Blazer fans love him. Danilo Gallinari is still going to be starting for them likely. They got Jokic and Nurkic in the front court, and they still have Fareed. But I'm looking up and down this roster, and is there any franchise altering level talent on this roster?
I'll say this. There's very few franchise level altering guys. I think if we're saying we're counting guys who are superstars, I'd say there's no more than what, 5-6 real superstars. And that's pushing it. It's all about your definition of superstar. But like the Golden State motto last year was strength in numbers, even though we know that their strength is really three guys. Here it's the real deal. So we talked about Gallinari. We talked about Emmanuel Mudiay, who I think is going to be a very, very good point guard in this league. He's big. He's strong. Yeah, he can't shoot. But, I mean, when you're big and strong like he can, get to your spots, that's something they can work on. They got shooting now. I think Murray's going to be a great shooter. And if Wilt Chandler comes back, he's very versatile. Big, I think the jewel here is, what's the guy's name? What's that big center's name they got? My man Yusuf Nurkic is there. He can play. He can really play. And then Nikola Jokic, however you want to say it, Nikola Jokic. Looking at the numbers, and this is one of the things that Denver fans told me all last year. I blew them off till I watched a little film on him. Jokic is right there talent-wise, a step below, half step below, but he's right up there with Karl Anthony Towns and Porzingis. The guy can really, really play. And the modern NBA is not about bigs, and they have some, a lot of quality bigs, but they also have a lot of quality guards too. So they're young, they're deep, they're going to have to solve their, you know, the depth issues and probably consolidate some of this in the next couple of years. For this year, you're not even worrying about, I don't think, wins and losses in Denver. It's about development. And they have a lot of young guys to develop. I'm really excited about them. They're like, when I was ready to jump ship on Boston this summer, Denver was one of my top three teams to go jump on the bandwagon for.
That's going to be an interesting team to watch, you know, if you like team basketball. And I think a lot of people do, because this is, like you mentioned, the epitome of a team that's going to have to embrace team basketball, not having that, you know, star level player per se. I mean, Emmanuel Mudiay definitely has the potential there, but in terms of a guy that they know who's going to be able to contribute night in and night out at a star level, I just don't know if they have it. And maybe the 2004 Pistons right now are shouting out to me and saying, hey, dude, what about us? What about how we did things? So you never know. Down the road, this could be one of those type teams that just is kind of the sum of its parts kind of a team. But I think, like you said, this year, it's not a team in the Northwest Division that the Blazers are going to have to worry too much about. I don't want to understate them or be disrespectful, but in terms of on paper, I don't think Denver looks to be challenging too much to win the Northwest Division. But I think probably the most intriguing team here for most people looking at the Northwest Division is going to be the Minnesota Timberwolves. I mean, you look at bringing in Tom Thibodeau. That's a huge move for a franchise where the direction that they're heading. I mean, you look at how long has it been since they've made the playoffs? I mean, is it 12 years now, 13 years now? I mean, they're just kind of.
It's back when Garnett was still there, right? I mean, it's been that long.
Oh, yeah. It's been that long, definitely. Yeah.
I mean, he's technically still there. He came back and.
That's a good point.
And maybe wrapping up his career there at age 40. I think he's going. Is this a record now going for 22 seasons? Because was it. Kareem played 21 seasons.
He hasn't decided yet if he's coming back. He doesn't know if he can, but yeah, it's up there.
If he does, I mean, playing at 40 years old, 22nd season, I think that would be great to have. I mean, what he means to that city, what he could be as a locker room guy for young guys like Karl Anthony Towns. I mean, look at this freaking roster that they have. The amount of talent that they have is astounding, and they have a backcourt that they're going to have to be able to, you know, work out. Tom Thibodeau is going to have his work cut out for him, trying to find minutes for everybody here. They have in the front court, they have Karl Anthony Towns, Andrew Wiggins, small four. They got Gorgui Dieng, Pekovic, if he could still play. I'm not really sure how healthy he is, how much they plan to use him. Then you look at, you know, a young guy who had, you know, some streaks of brilliance. Occasionally Shabazz Muhammad, come off the bench, kind of a scorer for them. And then you look at the backcourt, you got Tyus Jones. I think he was Summer League MVP there. You got Chris Dunn, another stud rookie. Zach LaVine, who they have a lot of belief in. I think they're not going to be, you look at who they drafted, they're not going to be shoehorning him anymore into the point guard spot. He's going to be playing off the ball, so that'd be good for him. And then they got, you know, Ricky Rubio, what to do with him. I mean, there's a lot of young talent on the Minnesota Timberwolves right now.
And a lot like Denver, I think sooner or later they're going to have to do some consolidating here where they move a couple guys for one, or, you know, let guys walk or do something, because they're just too deep. And we know what the core is. And right now, I don't think many teams, I don't think Minnesota would trade their core for almost anybody's. Right now, Karl-Anthony Towns has all the potential in the world. I'm pretty sure here in the next couple of years, he's going to be a top you know, a top what, maybe top eight player, and that's just being very conservative. He has all, he's just bristling with talent. Wiggins, he hasn't maybe exploded on the scene like people thought he was, but he still has all the room in the world to be a top grade player. And I mean, Wiggins is only, he's only 21. That's the crazy part about it. He's going to year three and he's been picked apart, but he's only 21. He's going to just get better. I'm not as high as Tyus Jones as you guys are, or as you are, Chris. Undersized point guards, he's not that small, but I don't know. We'll see. But honestly, I'm going to say this, and all the listeners out there, mark my words, book this. Denver is really close to these guys talent-wise, just not name-wise. However, the Timberwolves are further along, and I think my only question mark is the thing that you mark as a strength. We've never seen Coach Thibodeau start with such a young team. He stepped into that Bulls team. Don't forget, Vinny Del Negro had that Bulls team in the playoffs, I think the 2 years prior, and they were scrappy and they were kind of veteran, and they, even though they're young, they still have already been there. We're going to see if Tibbs has that developmental tool in his toolbox to help these guys grow along, because they're crawling, so he has to get them to walk and then maybe run in a couple of years. So the Timberwolves, they're going to make if they make a mini leap this year, they'll be good, but I still don't think they're on that Portland, Utah level yet.
Yeah, the Timberwolves to me are the most interesting team in the NBA, especially if you're looking over the next couple of years. It's going to be so much fun to see how Thibodeau puts his stamp on this franchise, which is much talent as they have. And one question I wanted to ask was, I mean, I know you're not high on Tyus Jones, but for how well he did play during Summer League and the rumblings that they want to get rid of Ricky Rubio, what would you make of that move if they were to get rid of Rubio and get some other parts and have Tyus Jones? I mean, I'm not sure if he's ready to run that team necessarily, but that team is not really ready to be a team per se at any rate. I mean, they're years out from being fully baked.
Yeah, and this is one of my it grinds my gears with the NBA. Orlando did this last year, and I'm hoping Minnesota doesn't do it this year, where they just decide, hey, we need to make the playoffs, and they try to cut corners to get that to happen. So I think if they end up, you know, from all my other thing I'm hearing is that they're not going to move Rubio, but if they do move Rubio, and they're pretty much showing, hey, we're content making this a development year, which is we're going to get guys in rotations, we're going to get them minutes, we're going to take our lumps. Which is fine. I think that's what they should do. I wouldn't be mad at them doing that, because I think Chris Dunn is going to be a stellar player. To me, he was watching the tape. He's going to be the best point guard out of this year's crop, and he has all the tools to be like a top flight, real deal NBA player.
If you're keeping Ricky Rubio, and Chris Dunn is your stud that you drafted to play point guard for the future, and you also have Tyus Jones there, I mean, obviously, I think the guy there who's not going to be getting minutes is Tyus Jones, right?
That's my thing. I mean, it's just a numbers game, right? Because there's going to be some lineups when I think even Zach LaVine might just step out there with Chris Dunn, and yeah, they just I don't know where it's. It was a nice pick for them last year. I just don't. They're so deep. And again, you can move Rubio for something. Here's my question with Rubio. He's almost like a little bit like Rondo. Where exactly does he fit? He's a better player than Rondo by far. But when you got a point guard who just really can't shoot and can't score, that just really puts a cap on your ceiling. And as good as Rubio is defensively and as a team guy and making an offense run, when you can't shoot, it really stifles an offense. So it'll be interesting to see what they do with Ricky Rubio.
With his limitations, he might have, you know, kind of that second unit all-star kind of written all over him, you know, kind of a guy who can, you know, dominate reserve units and bench players and stuff, where his shooting isn't necessarily such a detriment to the team, because he's not, if you're playing against backup guys, that wouldn't be as huge of an issue. And his defense, I mean, situationally, using him for his defense as well, I mean, there's ways Tibbs can use him. I'm wondering if keeping him happy is going to be legitimately possible with the amount, you know, that they're paying him. He was pretty much their franchise point guard before they drafted these couple of guys this summer, and now it looks like he might be potentially the odd man out.
Yeah, so for me, I'm gonna play a little devil's advocate, because with a team like Carl Anthony Towns, he can shoot it. We know Zach LaVine can fill it up. Chris Dunn, he's not a knockdown shooter, but he shot pretty well in college. Maybe this is a team with enough scoring everywhere else. You know, Brandon Rush is on the team. Maybe there's enough scoring everywhere else where they'd mitigate his lack of shooting by everything else he does. So, I mean, it's tough, and I know Minnesota fans love Rubio, so, you know, we might get chased with pitchforks and torches for saying this. But, yeah, I, I would almost want to see them move on for Rubio to give those young guys minutes and just say, let's make it a full youth movement. Kevin Garnett, Tayshaun, you guys are our locker room vets. You know, Brandon Rush, you're our shooter, but everybody else, I think you guys hit the nail on the head. I think Pekovic's about gone. He's about done. He has so many injuries. I don't think he can really play anymore. So, yeah, just make it a full-blown youth movement. Let these kids play.
The perpetual youth movement that Minnesota has been in since they traded Kevin Garnett in 2008, right?
You know what? David Kahn, I think they need to do a 30 for 30 on David Kahn because he just trashed this franchise and just set them back. He just nuked this franchise so terribly with his – I don't know what he was doing.
Well, you don't like Johnny Flynn?
I mean, it was just what a waste of years and years and picks, dude. I feel bad for Minnesota fans for having to go through that. They've done a great job of, you know, fixing his, but yeah, imagine where they would have been if they didn't have him as a GM.
So let's wrap here, looking a little bit, you know, at this hierarchy here in the Northwest Division. I'm a total homer. I think my bias is going to show through, Brandon. You probably as well. I'm looking at, I still think OKC is going to be the team to beat in the Northwest. Then I think the Blazers fall in behind them. I think the Jazz are pretty close behind. I think if both teams are healthy, I think Portland probably has the slight edge there. But I think that's going to depend on which team is more healthy there between Portland and Utah. And then I think it's going to be Minnesota. And then I think at the tail end there is going to be Denver. And I don't think Denver is going to be a terrible basement dwelling team by any stretch, but I don't know if they have the horses at the point in their development to run with the big boys in the division yet.
Yeah. I'm going to go out on a limb and say the Blazers are going to win the title this year, the division title.
All right.
I have Portland eking it out. I think the OKC is going to trade Westbrook, and so that's my thought. So I think they're going to be down there, and then Utah and Minnesota are going to be kind of nipping at Portland's heels, and then Denver and OKC at the bottom. That's how I have it.
Wow. All right. Is that breaking news? Westbrook's on the move.
It's so tough for me. It's tough for me to think about an OKC team looking at what they have and whatever pitch they're going to make to Russell Westbrook. Is it going to placate him? And I think they're going to come to the conclusion that it won't, and they're going to cut their losses.
Yeah, and it's a definite possibility. It's been talked about for a while. So I'm higher on Utah than you guys are. I think Utah's, while last year, obviously, Portland was a better team. I think injuries had a lot to do with that, and Utah got I think they upgraded those role players, man. I think people sell George Hill a little short because I think his time just got – it was his time to leave Indiana. He wasn't appreciated there. He's a really good player. I think they did a heck of a job getting in Joe Johnson and George Hill. I think Utah is going to win that division. Portland's going to be right there, though. It's going to be a battle. If Portland wins it, I'm not surprised because I just don't know if Portland made the prerequisite moves. You didn't lose anybody, but I think other guys around – you know, other teams around them got better. So Dame's awesome. I think CJ's going to make a step forward. I love Al-Farouq Aminu. I think Azeele, if he can play, he could be a difference maker for them. Just the perfect center for them. Rebound, block shots. I just think that Utah really upgraded, and if they can get healthy, I think they're a step ahead. Then I think it goes Portland. I think OKC is still ahead of Minnesota. I think they're going to keep Russ. And, yeah, I'm with you guys. Denver's in the sandbox still, messing around, while the other teams will be playing big boy basketball.
We'll see how it shakes out. I think a lot of this, you know, as is the case, the majority of years is going to boil down to what teams are able to stay the most healthy and avoid injuries. That typically seems to be what dictates which team wins this division when so many teams are so close together talent-wise. But we're going to wrap this podcast here. James, I want to thank you again for coming on, returning to the podcast again for the second time in a couple of months. It's always great to have you. Fans can check you out on Twitter at Snotty Drippin. It's at Snotty Drippin, right? Did I get it right Snotty this time? Drippin.
Yeah, that's an homage to my man Scottie Pippen, another guy's Portland fan should know very well. Just take Scottie Pippen and spell it so it sounds like Snotty Drippin, and that's me on Twitter. And you can find me over at bballbreakdown.com.
Excellent, man. Well, thanks again for coming on the show.
Hey, man, always fun, guys. I appreciate it. And I promise you, when I stop being lazy, I get my old pod back together. I would love to have both you guys on so we can talk some Blazers.
And we are all done with episode 156 of the Blazers Edge podcast. We'd like to thank you very much for joining us this week. Also, huge thanks to B-Ball Breakdowns, James Hollis at Snotty Drippin on Twitter for coming on the show. Also, we didn't get around to Twitter questions this week. We did solicit them, so don't be afraid to keep sending in Twitter questions. We will get to those in future weeks for you.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you to James for coming on. And yeah, you can send us questions pretty much anytime on Facebook or Twitter. We'll do our best to get to them the next time we record the podcast. Per usual, our intro and outro beats are brought to you by the magnificent Odar. You can check out his work at soundcloud.com/Odar Beats. Be sure to tune in to the Blazers Edge Midweek podcast with managing editor Dave Deckard and contributor Dan Marang. And for host Chris Lucia, I am Brandon Goldner. And remember, Evan Turner's haircut is only as annoying as you want it to be. But did that deal, did it make you Evan Turner your head?
Run around and cracking corny jokes.